Rose is your name, but when you poop, it sure don't smell like roses. Your number two burns the hair in my nose. But we fought hand in paw. Now your poop don't stink at all. Now that the air is clear, I'll treasure your front and rear, my sweet rose.
Instantly neutralize poop stink with Poop Fighter from World's Best Cat Litter for the world's best cat.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Nice night for a walk. Your clothes. Give them to me now.
Yes, welcome back, everyone, to the Silver Screen podcast. And that was a bit of a hint of what we are going to be looking at this week for this new episode. It's eagerly anticipated by some. Let me just start by saying, in the vast realm of sci-fi, there are certain movies that have carved out an indelible mark in the collective consciousness of moviegoers. And among them, James Cameron's 1984 movie, The Terminator, stands tall as a genre-defining film that continues to seemingly captivate audiences even decades after its original release. Directed by Cameron and starring Arnold Schwarzenegger, this sci-fi, thriller, slasher, horror remains a pivotal entry in the realm of time travel narrative and dystopian visions of the future. We here are three avid movie enthusiasts. I am your regular host, Mike Wilson. Hello. I'm joined by my usual co-host, DK.
Hello.
And we are joined once again with the triumphant return of the long-lost Will Templar.
Yay!
Woo!
Hello! 5 months, my God. I lost my computer, got a laptop, but I still can't fix my Wi-Fi issue. So thank you for having me back.
No problem. Well, just to give the audience a heads up then, you might be thinking, why The Terminator? Because normally we just do films that are related to something that's coming out in cinema and whatever. Well, we had this on the docket for a while because, believe it or not, Will had previously never seen The Terminator movies. Being his fantastic great friend, I bought him number one and two for Christmas last year to make him watch them, and knew that we could come around to reviewing them this year. So that was the plan. So it'll be a bit like old times, Will, when we were first recording back on different podcasts and everything, and I was introducing you to films.
Absolutely. I think that's how we first conceived the podcast. It was like just introducing each other to new things, be it Doctor Who episodes, like in Classic Who. And then when we went to films, we did films that we kind of loved or despised, and we never really, the other person never had seen it before. So it's nice to go back to our roots. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, fantastic. And safe to say, this film's probably better than the last Arnold Schwarzenegger movie I introduced you to for the first time.
Oh, what was that? I can't.
It was Batman and Robin.
Batman and Robin. Am I mistaken?
Oh, you poor bastard! Well.
Oh Lord! So yeah, no. Yeah, that was really, really bad. I still can't believe that. What was it? Marlon Brando got like $10 million for like a 3-second cameo. Jesus Christ!
That was Superman, dude. I did introduce you to that one as well, mind. But yeah.
Oh, am I getting the wrong film? Oh Lord.
Yeah, that was Superman you're thinking of. But it is true what you said. So, yeah. Oh, fair enough. Well, in any case, we decided because, you know, it's Will's first time, it'll be interesting to see from his perspective as a new viewer and a younger viewer, coupled with mine and DK's somewhat more experienced and, I'm guessing, not first-time viewing experience of this movie. Guessing you've seen it a few times, DK?
One or two.
That's fair enough. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see kind of does this movie have enduring appeal in the context of modern cinema? Because it was released at a time, obviously, when practical effects reigned supreme, and it was a bit of a landmark, pushed the boundaries of what was possible and blended a gripping storyline with fairly groundbreaking effects, and, yeah, created an adrenaline-fueled experience unlike anything seen before, I would say. Beyond the action-packed sequences and Schwarzenegger's memorable performance, I think it also posed some profound philosophical questions that explored the nature of humanity, ethical implications of artificial intelligence, quite timely at the minute, and the fragile balance between fate and free will. So, yeah, as we kind of rewatch or watch for the first time this classic film, we're going to be examining, does it continue to provoke such introspection and spark discussion on those kind of big themes? So, yeah, join us anyway as we embark on this journey through time and delve into the intricacies of The Terminator, from its screenplay to its influential cinematography and enduring legacy. We're going to dissect the film's various aspects, uncovering the reasons behind its lasting impact, maybe, on the genre. So fasten your seatbelts, adjust your timeline, and get ready to experience the thrill all over again as we delve into the world of The Terminator. So, yeah, we are going to do this the same way that we normally do our big reviews. We break it down into sections. When we get to the main review, it'll not be linear as such. It just tends to break down into writing, directing, plot, etc. But we always start with a behind-the-scenes section, and that is always the purview of the DK-800, as I'm going to call it this week. Cyberdyne Systems model DK-101 over there.
Have you seen this DK- boy?
Sarah Connor. Anyway, so you all set with the behind the scenes stuff for us?
I am, dude. Thank you.
I'm gonna see if I can play something. Let's see if this sounds suitably Terminator-esque. I would rather have been playing the Brad Fidel Terminator score, but we'd get immediately copyright strike.
Yeah,
if I was to do that. So we'll just have to go with night driving. It seems vaguely Terminator-esque.
So, I guess. Take it away.
I mean, thanks, man. it's either that or like dance pop.
Yeah, this'll do. It's a quiet night at Tech Noir.
Right. We have some time, it's hilarious. Wait. There you go.
Oh, there we go. That's all right. It's a good track to put on a trench coat and shoot somebody.
That's nice. Don't say things like that, dude. Jeez.
Okay. Now, James Cameron initially envisioned the idea for the Terminator script while ill in Rome. He was involved in post-production on his previous movie, the one he doesn't like to talk about, Piranha 2, The Spawning. After spending the last of his own money on the flight out to Rome, the story goes that he didn't have enough money for food and, increasingly sick from lack of nutrition, went to bed one night with a fever. As he slept, he had a nightmare of a metal endoskeleton emerging from a fire and dragging itself across the floor by kitchen knives in its hands. When he woke up, he made a drawing of the vision and began working on a script, writing backwards from that initial premise. The endoskeleton aspect was futuristic, but due to money issues, obviously, setting it in the future was not possible, which necessitated the inclusion of time travel. Now, this first draft was much more elaborate than the final film version and included two Terminators and two Resistance fighters being sent back. The first Terminator, the endoskeleton version, would be destroyed during the course of the movie, so Skynet would send back another variant, one consisting of liquid metal, with the thought of using claymation in dark shots to portray the shape-shifting aspect of this second assassin. Now, realizing that it wouldn't work and prove problematic for a relatively inexperienced director to sell this idea to the studio, he removed the liquid metal Terminator from the script and kept the first half only. Second half would have to wait several years after the CGI used in Cameron's 89 movie The Abyss convinced him that a liquid metal Terminator was now feasible. And then he returned to the idea and finished off his original script in 1991's T2. Now, carrying this trend on, two deleted scenes from the movie. One where Connor finds out that Skynet was created by the company Cyberdyne, and one where a chip was taken from the Terminator's arm by an employee of Cyberdyne, both removed from this movie to create more ambiguity. And again, as we all know, they were used as plot points in the second film.
Sorry to interject, but I will just say that I do have a section that I'll get to later on the deleted scenes, because I watched them on the Blu-ray, and that is among them. There's some really cool things that they cut, which would have set up that sequel in a different way, but we'll talk about that later.
Cool, no worries. Now, in the original script, Sarah Connor has an old skating injury that was fixed with surgical pins, with the Terminator cutting open the legs of the first two victims to find said pins. This was obviously removed for the final script. However, in the novelization, the pins are there, but instead of a skating injury, they were inserted after her leg was broken during the final battle with the Terminator. Skynet knew that Connor had them, but not how she received them. Thus, the Terminator was looking for the sign of an injury she had not yet sustained. Wibbly wobbly tiny whiny. It's all right. Now, Cameron initially didn't want Schwarzenegger in the role of the Terminator. He was originally approached by Orion Pictures executive Mike Medavoy after meeting him at a party to play Reese, the man who would come back in time and coin the term MILF. Now, Cameron reportedly didn't want Reese to have the bulk Schwarzenegger, and only agreed to meet with Arnold at the insistence of Medavoy, planning on picking a fight with him at the meeting and then claiming he would be impossible to work with. Cameron instead found Schwarzenegger so charming and so enthusiastic about the script, despite apparently not caring for it at all that much, that he offered him the role, saying, "It's not about the hero, it's all about the Terminator." For his part, Schwarzenegger overruled his own agent, who had advised him against taking villain roles. As for the Terminator, despite rumours to the contrary, Lance Henriksen was apparently not up for the role and just turned up to the studio meetings dressed as the titular character to make the execs nervous. Spoiler, it worked. Sylvester Stallone and Mel Gibson were briefly considered, as was, believe it or not, O.J. Simpson, who producers passed on as they feared he was, and I quote, "too nice to play a cold-blooded killer."
Oh dear.
Now, yeah.
Irony.
That aged like milk. Now, the Schwarzenegger-Cameron friendship continues to this day, with apparently the only time the pair had a major disagreement was during the filming of this movie. The original line in the script was apparently, "I will come back," which was then changed to, "I'll be back." However, Schwarzenegger apparently didn't like the line as written, thinking it would be more machine-like to not use contractions, and read it as, "I will be back." Cameron, in response, stated, "I don't tell you how to act, so don't tell me how to write." Now, the club, Technoir, named after a style of film that Cameron coined, was built specifically for the movie. The crew had to turn away local club goers who thought it was a real nightclub. Still exists. It's now a jewelry store, however. And Schwarzenegger allegedly delayed the shoot by 2 days as he thought the custom-made leather jacket he wore as the Terminator wasn't manly enough. Now, in foreign titles, in Polish, a Terminator is another name for apprentice. So when released in Poland, this movie was originally given the title of The Electronic Murderer. Yeah. The truck that runs over the Terminator towards the end of the movie, it's the same model of truck as the toy version that the Terminator drives over at the beginning of the movie. And finally, the crew had shirts made up during the production of the movie that simply read, "You cannot scare me. I work for James Cameron."
Indeed. Right. So is that everything you have for the behind-the-scenes section?
It is. There's a little bit later on when we're discussing the movie, but that's it for this section, yeah.
That's fair enough. You did say you had stuff about the writing, and it's a movie that I know a fair bit about, so maybe I'll be able to interject with bits and pieces as well. So yeah, let me just stop that music.
"You've been targeted for termination."
There we go. I found as many quotes as I could just to shove in for no reason.
"I'm waiting for you, Miss Gutterfoot, and put her fucking heart out."
Then you always, Mike. Then you always.
"It's not a man. Machine. Terminator. Cyberdyne Systems Model 101.
Okay, that'll do for now. So, yeah, thanks for that, DK. It's, yeah. So before we jump in, then, I did want to ask Will, since it is the first time you've watched that movie, as spoiler-free as possible, what were your overall thoughts coming off watching this for the very first time?
So I do mention it in my notes, but you did mention about how some of the effects were, like, groundbreaking. So I went into it anticipating quite a bit, to be fair, even though you did say it aged quite a bit. And in retrospect, I now know what you were thinking of, because I was thinking of something else in terms of like the stunt work and whatever, but not the actual stop motion effects or whatever the hell they use for the animations. But otherwise, I just thought it was a really, really, you know, amazing action horror film. What would you even call it? A horror film or an action film? Because I can't say it's a horror because it plays out the same as like Halloween would, for example. But just with the action set pieces, of course.
Yeah, that's exactly what a discussion that I was going to have, and I've made it in my notes, because this is a discussion that came up when I was at university, because I had a lecturer in horror films that insisted that this film is a slasher film, except with guns instead of knives. And you're exactly right, it does play out just like that, right down to, you know, the relentless killer stalking and killing innocent people, the final girl, you know, the killer who you think is dead and then comes back and, you know, just keeps on coming, and as you ripped off his legs and he still comes at you and whatever else. So I always think of it kind of as a slasher film. Other people kind of don't like that term and would say it's like a thriller or an action thriller or sci-fi thriller horror, whatever. But I think it's kind of weird, because I think I kind of compare it in some ways to the Alien franchise, where I would say Alien is definitely a horror movie. Aliens is just straight up action. And I think Terminator 1 and 2 are similar. The first one is very...
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Very kind of atmospheric horror, and the second one is just pure sci-fi action movie, basically. So yeah, well, Will, I'll come to you as the first time viewer, not to keep putting you on the spot, but what did you think of the acting? the main actors in this movie, well, how did you think of the performances? And
you see, I'm more mixed than I'm sure a lot of people are. With Arnie, I think it was a fantastic performance. It was inspired casting with like the very robotic-y voice, so it kind of makes sense for him to be like an android, because even when he's on like the Logan Paul podcast as well, his like natural speaking voice is like the Terminator. It's very similar, so he didn't really have to put too much into it. Of course, he put a lot into it. Whereas I do think, what's his name? Michael, I can't even pronounce the second name.
It's just
Michael Bean. whereas with him, I think he was unfortunate because he had to do a lot of the explanations to the audience. Well, to Sarah and then through the audience that way. So I think he kind of suffers from what he was given with the exposition wise. And I think that's very clear in the car sequence where he's talking to her for the first time and like explaining what's going on as like they're on the pursuit. So I think he was unfortunately let down. However, I thought everyone else, like the police department, like the constable, they were all like reassuring presences, and then like moments later they got gunned down by the Terminator. But for their fleeting moments, I thought everyone was kind of perfect.
Fair enough. And DK, just general thoughts, and then I'll have a few things I kind of want to bounce off you guys, if you don't mind. But just generally, what did you think of the acting?
I'm kind of in the same boat as Will. I mean, everybody was pretty spot on. Unfortunately, Bean did have a lot of the exposition, and some of the dialogue did come across as, you know, a bit corny, a bit hackneyed. But, you know, we're 40 years out of this, and it's going to seem like that no matter what. Even still, there are some wonderful lines that Bean has. So yeah, as it comes to acting, I think they all did a bang up job.
Yeah, fair enough. Are you talking about cheesy lines like
the 600 series had rubber skin? We spotted them easy, but these are
new. Yeah.
I don't mind, to be honest, but yeah. So
It's all right for what it is. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. As I said, we're 40 years on, and we've had a lot of this stuff since then. So it is going to come across like that. It's like your old Chandler novels.
Yeah. I guess so. Raymond Chandler type thing. Yeah, fair enough. But yeah, and as you said, it is, as we were kind of alluding to genre, this is, it's said to have created a genre of its own, that being tech noir, which is the name of the club. And I can kind of see where they're coming from with that as well, the kind of idea of a cyberpunk tech future thing coupled with the, you know, the trappings of an old film noir almost. So
yeah,
there's that kind of mix of atmospheres. And yeah, you can see why it kind of started and was a bit groundbreaking in that respect. But that's probably for a discussion for a later moment. But yeah, so what I did want to ask was, yeah, Will, this is your first exposure to these movies. So what do you think about the idea or the famous concept that Sarah Connor is like a feminist icon? And what did you think of her journey throughout this movie?
To be fair, I thought the ending was like spot on with her character being the focal point of the film, because she is the most important aspect of this film, not specifically the Terminator, because the Terminator obviously goes after her, so she's integral to it. So her journey throughout the film played out just as it should have, in my opinion. And I think the love story especially wasn't, you've said the word already, corny. I don't think that like played out corny at all. I think she was strong, and I think she quite rightly was the one to destroy, quote unquote, destroy the Terminator towards the end. Not sure what there is much else to say about that.
Yeah, no, that's. I mean, you're basically saying more or less the same stuff that I would have. But before I jump in and see if I've got anything different to add, what about you, DK? What do you make of this kind of Sarah Connor journey and the growth of her as a feminist icon? Obviously, without touching on Terminator 2, which I think is probably the main focus of that kind of discussion, but I think it's definitely present here. What did you think of it in this movie?
Oh, definitely. I mean, you only start to really see it towards the end, once Reese is kind of not necessarily out of the picture, but once you can't really rely on him as much, and you do see the foundations and of the character that she would eventually turn into.
Yeah, and I think, as you said, even at the very end of the movie, when she's, you know, she's pregnant with John and she's starting to come to terms with it all, I think there's the hint of that. But yeah, I mean, I do see a real change in her as the movie progresses, because I sometimes forget, because I'm that sort of, you know, au fait with this entire franchise, how much she starts to, as the kind of, you know, unlucky, hapless, put upon, I'm going to have to put on a smile and face the day, and this annoying kid's just poured ice cream in my shirt or whatever. And it's like, yeah, that's such a complete difference. And then even when she goes home, her and her roommate Ginger are just, they are the 1980s personified in human form.
She loves her music.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, I did notice, like, even as Sarah's like cowering in the police station and stuff later, she's, maybe this was deliberate, maybe not, but the costume, people have her wearing pink, which is traditionally the more sort of feminine, weak, you know, no offense, but weak seeming idea. And I'm not sure if they were deliberately kind of playing that as she was, you know, that she started out that way and then grew beyond it. But yeah, I mean, even as Reese first meets her and he's trying to tell her the importance that she's going to have and that John, her son, will have, she kind of doesn't believe him, and she gives him the whole, am I tough? Am I organized? I can't even balance my checkbook, you know. But then by the end of the movie, you have her trying to pull up Reese's dying sort of body and get on your feet, soldier. And of course, you know, by the time you reach the very end of the film, she's the one that delivers this fantastic line.
Someone take the soundboard off him.
I'll try not to use it too much more, but yeah, just your Terminator fucker at the very end, as you said.
Ryan's going to send someone back just to wipe you out for this soundboard.
Yeah, 3 years ago. Well, 4 years in his case, old man.
I am Skynet. Check out my profile picture. Look, I am a Terminator. Anyway, but like I said, it was deliberately, it was quite clearly Sarah that got the agency and got to finish off her nightmare there. And
I mean, when she starts, she is almost like a rom-com archetype.
Yes,
character.
Well, not even, it's relates to what both Will and I were saying. I think they are both slasher stereotypes, especially Ginger, as she's wandering around like, you know, my boyfriend's getting murdered in the other room, but I've got my Walkman on, so I can't hear. That is a scene that could be in a Halloween movie, you know?
Yeah, and it's definitely fiction, because I had a Walkman back then and you could hear a pin drop.
Yep, agreed. Yeah, I don't care how loud the music was you were listening to. The headphones of any Walkman we had were not that powerful.
Which says a lot for the performance of a boyfriend, really, while she's like, you know, head banging to her music while they're going at it. That's, you know, he's hapless. Jesus.
Poor hapless fellow. Anyway, obviously you talked about Michael Biehn. I personally thought Michael Biehn was great. I was really impressed because I think he's, to me, he came across as every bit the action hero, and he's kind of leading the charge because he's the one that, as you said, knows everything. So he's got to impart this information. Did you guys see him as a convincing action hero or not really?
I did. I did like it's partly down to Biehn, it's partly down to how it's written, and it's partly down to the direction. But I did love, for the first third of the movie, the ambiguity that you don't know if Reese is, you know, the same as Arnie, really. If he's there, just even though you had the thing where he didn't outright kill the homeless guy and just, you know.
Man, that guy took my pants, man. Sorry, yeah. I didn't have the soundboard for that. I just had to do it myself.
I couldn't tell. It was uncanny.
Lawless, wasn't it?
Yeah, so, yeah, I did like the ambiguity there. But, yeah, I'm glad that he eventually, obviously, Cameron thought so when he replaced James Remar with him later on.
In Aliens, of course, yeah. Yeah. Not that it's relevant right now, but he also has a fantastic scene in Terminator 2 that's only in the extended version. It was cut from the theatrical, but it's really good in that.
With the Terminator 2, I was going to watch it later this week. What should I watch, the original or the director's cut?
I would go with the director's cut, the extended version, definitely.
Roger that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely, it's far superior. Same as Aliens, I would always say go with the director's cut, the extended version of that as well.
Yeah, I've watched the director's cut, and I absolutely think it makes like a 4 out of 5 film, a 5 out of 5. It's so much
better. Yeah, I would agree. Yeah, fully, absolutely. That's cool. Well, so yeah, but I did want to bring up, like, in terms of the acting and stuff, I don't know if you didn't really have it in the behind the scenes section, so I'm not sure if you're aware of it, that Michael Biehn was kind of, he was basing his performance on like World War II prisoners of war, and particularly the Polish resistance, apparently.
I never saw that bit.
Yeah, you can kind of see it in his performance, especially in the flash forwards, I guess you would call them, the sort of flashbacks to the machine war that's in the future, but yeah, time travel. But yeah, you know what I mean? The flashes to the future of, you know, when he's leading the people underground and the T-600, I think it is, infiltrates. You can kind of see where that's coming from as they're struggling. And I think he has genuine, believable rage and intensity, to be honest with you. And he has to do that annoying thing of explaining to somebody who doesn't believe you, which can come off really annoying. And I don't think it does here. Also, in terms of, this is me going into full-on annoying film study student mode again, but in terms of symbolism, it's, I think, yeah, people have pointed out he does emerge in a white light, starts out in pain, and says it's like being born. Plus, he has scars on his back, which are exactly where angel wings would be, and says he would die for John Connor, whose initials, by the way, are JC. So if you want to look for this, you know, the symbolism guy, there.
Now, but I'm just saying it's with, DK about the ambiguity, and I think because of that exposition scene about a third of the way through, perhaps it was a little bit jarring. Like, I could never place my finger on what the problem was, but because of DK's good point of, like, the ambiguity at the start, and you don't really know what's going on, you're just like a passive viewer experience what is this film at the start. So for it to go straight to exposition is a little bit untoward, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think it kind of has to, though, because there's a lot to try and clue the audience in on, even to the point that it does it with the little sort of text scroll at the start of the movie, and it still doesn't fully... Yeah, but I liked it. Yeah, it still doesn't fully fill you in on what's going on, but it's a surprisingly complex story that I think we are more easily able to understand and stuff because we are nerds and we watch a lot of time travel films and Doctor Who and stuff, so... We don't really have to wrap our heads around it in the way that perhaps an average audience might have to.
Yeah. I mean, this story is very close to home nowadays. We're living through it pretty much. I'm scared that it's like 6 years away, I think, in the future this is set now, like to our current selves. And it doesn't seem that unrealistic.
Yeah, no. Absolutely. Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, with the growing sort of emergence of AI and stuff, it's absolutely back in the news and back to potentially being very prescient again, which, as I said, it's weird how these themes just keep coming up and people don't seem to learn, which is weird. Because
mate, have a speak to Snapchat AI. You will be horrified with the some of the things it comes up with.
Yeah, I have a friend who's made it his job in recent weeks to just go on there and argue with it
post a transcript. Like you on the internet.
Yeah, pretty much.
How are you doing, man?
I know, right?
I can't help it. Those Snyder Bros, dudes.
Yeah, I respect it. I saw it.
Oh, bless your heart. Anyway,
but, sticking with the theme of superheroes, it's like that meme that people saying the most realistic MCU villain was Ultron. Dude spent 5 minutes on the internet and decided humanity had to go.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. No hope for humanity. No, bringing it back to the acting, because again, you guys have already touched on this, but I'm in complete agreement with you, Will, which doesn't always happen, but I also thought the love story was fantastic and really believable, and it's not something that I'm usually all right with in movies. I'm very critical when it comes to these things, but, and to be fair, there's a chance that Kyle could have come off as a bit stalkery and a bit creepish, especially when it's like, I've had this photo of you for so long and I came back through time to find you, and yet it doesn't. It just comes off as romantic, and they literally get a room.
it was the right level of pompous. It was like subliminal, and I just think it played out really impressively. And again, I had the same issue with, well, not the same issue, the same potential issue of it could have been a bit stalkery, but it just seemed really sweet as well, because of, you know, by that point you're aware of the stakes and where he's come from, so it kind of, not cliche, but you can kind of put two and two together, and it does work.
Yeah, I think the acting, certainly plays a huge part in that, but also the direction and the writing. So, like, for example, the key line for me is, in the few hours that we had together, we loved a lifetime's worth. To say that and not come off like a really bad Mills and Boone novel make it believable, I'm like, that's really good, you know? I'm here for it. And it does it play into these ideas of, like, fate, and maybe they were soulmates that were destined to get together? Because then he kind of tells her the opposite and says, you can make your own fate. So again, it raises some pretty interesting questions, perhaps. We briefly touched on it, but I did want to say, there isn't a lot to say about Arnie, other than obviously this is perfect because he doesn't have to do or say very much. Which,
you just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy, just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
People said at the time it's perfectly suited for him. DK, I think you know the exact number of lines of dialogue he has, right?
Yeah, 17 lines, 16 of which were original. One was repeated.
Yeah. because he does do intimidating really well, and he, even like the way that he moves or tilts his head and stuff, he does the robotic mannerisms really well. And as far as I'm aware, that wasn't anything that was taught. That was the kind of the reason he got the job, because he was basically instructing James Cameron on how the actor, whoever they cast as the Terminator, should move and should look. And Cameron's even said, like, casting Schwarzenegger goes against the plot, because the Terminator is supposed to be an infiltration unit that you wouldn't spot in a crowd. And Schwarzenegger's going to stand out in a crowd, you know? He's not blending in.
It is LA. They do have Muscle Beach there.
Yeah, but I mean, like, in the future, for example, they're supposed to be infiltrating,
I would imagine a guy looking like, you know, a stocking full of walnuts isn't unusual there.
Well, you said it. But, I don't have much else on the acting, except I wanted to bring up a couple of things. First of all, DK, your boy Dick Miller, who we just saw in Gremlins, makes another sly little appearance.
Yeah, Mr. Futterman getting blown away.
Hey, just what you see, pal, whatever.
Yeah, the problem is now, you look at that scene and you think, well, that's pretty much everyday life now.
Yeah, I know, it's disturbing. And it's really weird to us, well, I don't know about you, but it's weird to me as an English audience that they're walking in and he's like, well, some of these things, they have a 7-day waiting period. You can walk out of here with some of them right now. And I'm like, Jeez, that country is ass backwards.
Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to bring up, this is a really geeky thing, but it does feature Bill Paxton in the intro, along with Brian Thompson as the punks that get, you know, attacked and one killed, several traumatized by the Terminator.
Also, Brian Thompson's jaw.
Indeed. But there was a kind of geeky thing going around for a while that Bill Paxton was the only person who has been killed by a Terminator, an alien, and a Predator. But as I researched this, people are in disagreement because they say that the Terminator didn't kill the punk at the start of this movie, other than the Brian Thompson version of the character, that Bill Paxton survived. So he may have faced all three, but he wasn't killed by all three. And certainly by the time you get to Alien versus Predator, that title goes to Lance Henriksen, who was then being killed by an alien in Aliens, a Terminator in The Terminator, and a Predator in Alien versus Predator. And I think it's fairly you know, obvious in those cases. So just a little geeky fact there for anybody who's curious. And I just want to say quickly, yeah, the supporting cast, as Will already said, all do brilliantly. The late Paul Winfield as the head detective, who obviously DK and I will know from Wrath of Khan and the Next Gen episode Darmok.
I know. I know.
Shaka.
And, yeah, exactly. Plus, obviously, the aforementioned Lance Henriksen, bit of a, you know, a legend in just genre generally. And Earl Bowen as Dr. Silberman, who would reappear in Terminators 2 and 3 in the same role as this kind of psychologist who's very crap at his job. So, yeah.
I can jump in here if you're struggling with the acting notes. And it was towards the end, really. And it's more of like a practical effects note, I suppose. But you know how you have like those tennis balls sometimes that actors kind of have to use as an eyeline for creatures and whatever that aren't there?
Yeah, nowadays, yeah, totally.
Yeah, towards the end, there's the moment in the factory where the final like battle kind of takes place and where the Terminator is kind of quote-unquote defeated. And it was a stop animation or the animation, whatever the hell it is.
It is stop motion, by the way. I should have said that when you mentioned it earlier, but it is.
When it's in like full effect, where it's being completely used in all of these shots. And Carl goes to close the door, and then you have this really bad animation of the Terminator coming up towards the door. And I just thought, why wasn't there a Terminator-shaped tennis ball just there for Carl or Michael to actually use?
They didn't have CGI, dude. It was 1984.
No, but what I'm saying is have something there to give him like a reference as to where the animation would be.
Oh, I see. Yeah, well, I presume they might have. I don't know. Maybe not, but yeah, it's weird. But yeah, it's kind of weird that all the techniques that we know in terms of special effects don't work, and by our standards, it's surprising how well this holds up, considering how primitive. I mean, it is stop motion, like Ray Harryhausen style at the end, once it becomes the endoskeleton. But again, we'll talk about that probably a little bit more later on. I've definitely got notes about the special effects and things. But yeah, so I've exhausted my notes on the acting. Did you guys have anything else you wanted to add?
Not really.
No, that's pretty much it. But everybody in this is kind of when you look at them now, they're a kind of legend in the genre.
Yeah. I mean, it's a fantastic cast, even with Brian Thompson, who you're apparently not very fond of. But yeah,
I don't dislike him. I just think, really, this guy has an equity card.
You just hold Mortal Kombat Annihilation against him, clearly.
Anybody that was in Mortal Kombat Annihilation, I hold that against them.
Valid. No, I did read that this film gave a lot of actors their big breaks, like it put them on the map, so to speak.
That's the other thing I did want to mention, DK, because you kind of alluded to it in the behind the scenes that, James Cameron, to get the movie made, apparently had Lance Henriksen dress as the Terminator in the clothes that he wears at the start of the movie. And instead of doing any kind of pitching, you would send him in sort of 10, 15 minutes earlier than Cameron. And he would just walk in, look intimidating, sit down, say nothing. And then Cameron would walk in and tell them. And I was like, they are really lucky that that paid off and didn't just result in like Henriksen getting arrested or something, you know? Anyway, so we'll move on to the writing / plot next, and DK, this seems like a good time to throw it over to you, because you did definitely have something about this. Yes,
yeah, it's a little long, but it's going on to the acknowledging the works of Harlan Ellison.
Yes, I know this story.
Yeah, it's for anybody that don't know. I mean, I am quoting an article here from Comic Book Resources, but it is pretty well sourced, this one. So James Cameron versus Harlan Ellison. You know, this is where you probably insert that let them fight gif. But Yeah, Harlan Ellison wasn't happy with this. I mean, as it goes, Cameron can be innovative. And yeah, it's one of those movies that is kind of a milestone in the genre. But Harlan Ellison wasn't having any of it. He slapped him with a lawsuit claiming it was a ripoff of his two Outer Limit scripts, Demon with a Glass Hand and Soldier. It didn't help when on the set, Tracy Torme asked Cameron where he got the idea for the Terminator from. And apparently Cameron was quoted as saying, "Oh, I ripped off a couple of Harlan Ellison stories."
See, I've heard that's very apocryphal and not true, but
yeah. But then we've got another thing with a defense attorney for Harlan Ellison, an interview in Starlog magazine. It says, after a week after my attorney contacted Hendale, I got a call from the editor of Starlog. Turned out Cameron had given an interview, and after I began inquiring at Hendale, the Terminator producer Galen Hurd sent Starlog a legal demand to see the interview. According to Ellison, Galen Hurd then modified Starlog's article on the Terminator. She omitted a quote from Cameron in the article that read, "I took a couple of Outer Limits segments." The reason that the Starlog editor had contacted Ellison was to provide him with the original version of the article, the one without Galen Hurd's editing. Said Ellison, "At this point, we went to Hendale and to Orion and we said, I'm afraid we've got him with a smoking gun. Now, do you want to do something about this or do you want us to whip your ass in open court? We'd be perfectly happy to do it either way." Between the account of Tracy Torme and the Starlog interview, the attorneys for Hendale and Orion quickly realized that they wanted no part of a lawsuit. By Ellison's accounts, they took one look at this ship and their attorney said, "Settle." Now, it's disputed exactly how much Ellison got beside the acknowledgement credit. He said 65 to 70,000, but other reports said it was closer to 400,000, all said and done. Now, the fact that they settled on a relatively weak infringement claim, it says the article, does suggest that Ellison's not lying when he says that the Cameron comment was edited out of the Starlog article. That's a huge smoking gun. Hendale, the financiers of the film, and Orion were willing to go to court, but only if Cameron was willing to pay them if they lost. Cameron later said, "It was a nuisance suit that could easily have been fought. I expected Hendale and Orion to fight for my rights, but they abandoned me. The insurance company told me if I didn't agree to the settlement, they would come after me personally for the damages if they lost the suit. Having no money at the time, I had no choice but to agree to the settlement. Of course, there was a gag order as well, so I couldn't tell this story, but now I frankly don't care. It's the truth. Harlan Ellison is a parasite who can kiss my ass." So, yeah, it's down to who you believe.
As I say, I did do similar kind of, well, not for this episode, but I know this kind of story because I know this film quite well. And, yeah, the most recent kind of James Cameron stance on it seems to be, you know, Ellison was just a complete chancer. And he says he resents the fact that his name is on this movie. And if it was, you know, if it was now, we would absolutely have fought it, but he was basically pressurized into just taking the settlement and being done with it. And then it was out of the way. But yeah, I mean, it's James Cameron and Harlan Ellison, two of the famously least likable people in yes. You know, writing and Hollywood and whatever else you want to say. So it is kind of like, you know,
and when you look at things like Avatar, it's not completely out of the realms of fiction for Cameron to have taken an idea from someplace else.
No, but likewise, we did our review of The City on the Edge of Forever, so we also know how Harlan Ellison likes
be an absolute asshole sometimes.
And he kind of likes to claim that a lot of ideas that aren't his were his works of genius as well, you know?
Yeah, so, but having a look at the plot of Soldier, it is... There are similarities there, it can be said. And having Cameron come out and say this only after Ellison's passed seems a bit, I don't know.
No. Yeah, it's one of those weird ones, but I do tend to believe that, whether it's partly inspired by that or not, that I believe Cameron's story that he kind of woke up in a fever during the making of Piranha 2 and had this image of a metal, you know, human skeleton in fire, you know, emerging to attack him. And yeah, I mean, like I said, from there, maybe he got the time travel plot from Soldier or whatever else, but I don't believe it's that egregious. But like I said, these two people are not the best humans anyway, so it's, yeah.
Who do you root for in this, really?
Yeah.
Whoever wins, we lose.
Precisely, to bring it back to Alien versus Predator. But yeah. So no, that was an interesting sort of weird thing to know. It is worth noting, and I'm kind of glad we have it down for posterity. But yeah, to get kind of back into the writing then, did you have any other more general thoughts about the film that aren't about who wrote what, DK?
Yeah, I do like the little line from Reese that says, you know, one possible future where Connor's asking him. And yeah, there is some corny, as I said, some, you know, a little corny dialogue, but there's some fucking gems in there. The little passage which says,
"Thank you, Sarah, for your courage through the dark years. I can't help you with what you must soon face, except to say that the future is not set. You must be stronger than you imagine you can be. You must survive, or I will never exist."
I was contacted actually today by a friend who went through quite a traumatic childhood. Well, I say childhood, teen years. And they told me that that quote, above everything else that they can remember in media, got them through some of the darkest times.
That's fair enough. Yeah. So, Will, what about you? Did you have any sort of general thoughts on the writing, the overall plot of the movie?
Yeah, since we're not going in order of where these scenes actually come into it, I may as well just jump to the ending. I like how they go for like the defensive slash offensive route of the film narrative structure. For example, the ending is far more rewarding for me, since the first two acts always have Sarah and Kyle on the defense. They make love, have a streak of intelligent luck, and become determined to defeat the Terminator. Whereas for the opening hour, it was a relentless charge from the Terminator. Amazingly depicted in Sarah's hopelessness when at the police station and the Terminator takes away any hope she had by killing every single person that was willing to help her other than the then Mad Hat Kyle. So I thought that was sublime, and that I think that was a shifting point in their relationship between Sarah and Kyle, and that's where the love story kind of did prevail, in my opinion. Yeah, it kind of contradicts what you said earlier about, you know, Sarah being a very feminine,
feminist hero.
Feminist hero and whatever, when in the police station, Kyle does come to her rescue, and that's like the next 20 minutes of the film. He just protects her and whatever, he gets her out of that sticky situation. However, like you guys did mention towards the start of the review, thankfully, it does take that turn when Carl is like taken out of the equation and she can kind of come back into it. It was just at that moment she really needed him. And yeah. That makes everything that comes afterwards more plausible, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think it's more that he had to kind of teach her, you know, the things that she was going to have to know going forward, because it is telling that she starts speaking in his language. Like, I do think it's key that she, to try to get to him, get on your feet, soldier, and she's kind of learned that dialogue and that way of talking to people. So
exactly. Yeah. They're always on edge, even though, like, he instills that in her, even when they're, like, making love, for example, when the Terminator comes up to their motel, they're already one step ahead. Like, they can't have that sense of, like, calmness and no urgency.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's the film's kind of like that. I mean, that's one of the things that I kind of like about it, is that it is very...
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Very pacey, if that makes sense. It never seems to slow down. So you always get this, it kind of fits the title character, because there is this relentless sense that something's in the background coming for you, and it just keeps moving and it will not stop. And the film itself kind of is like that, which is like, I personally would have included a lot of the deleted scenes in the movie because I like them. But by the same token, I'm not a director, and it probably helped the pace that, you know, it's down to, I think it's only an hour and 40 minutes in length, something like that.
It's a really short film,
yeah, which by our standards is a really short film. By 1984 standards, it's probably average, but yeah, it's just weird because I think there's no fat on it, basically. There's no scene where you're like, well, you could have cut that, you could have cut that. And quite the opposite, there's things I might have added, but yeah, that was sort of a writing thing.
Besides at the start, though, I think there were quite a few meandering scenes, and I did research this just before I jumped on, and I was like, I don't want to make an ass of myself, so I researched it. And apparently some people do think some of the scenes at towards the start, I can't name any examples, but they were a bit surplus to requirements. It kind of took a few minutes too long to actually get into the meat of the story. And well, I do think the pace of the start was a bit meandery, so perhaps that was the reason, because of those scenes that didn't really add much to the plot. I'm not sure.
See, I don't know if there is anything that I would say that, because I think it's all set up that takes you, like, cause as far as I can remember, there's a lot of kind of, there's a few scenes in the future, which I love all of those scenes because they look incredible, especially... Yeah. Considering they're all model shots, basically, as well. It's just, exceptional. So I love anytime you do that. And then it's just basically setting up Sarah. And like I said, the fact that she's put upon and run down and has a kind of crap life. And then you're setting up that coupled with the Terminator going around knocking on doors to find the right Sarah Connor. So I don't think there's anything that's superfluous in those scenes. It's set up for the stuff that would be important. But yeah. Yeah, because he's just checking the phone book and going down, you know, each Sarah Connor in order.
It's mad how if she hadn't found her roommate, then everything would have been okay. Like, the Terminator just killed her, and then he, like, hears her on the answer machine. And I was like, oh, well, the movie could have ended after about 10 minutes if she just didn't call.
Yeah, but she called because she was freaked out by seeing the fact that people called Sarah Connor were getting killed. So that's another one of those.
The Terminator would have been like, oh, yeah, I killed her. I came to the address, killed her, now I'm gone.
Well, he didn't know that she was Sarah Connor. I'm presuming he would have figured it out by looking at ID or whatever, the same as he was able to figure out. Well, actually, perhaps. That's one of the deleted scenes, which I will bring up now, is that the Terminator kind of walking away from the older Sarah Connor, the first one that he kills, when he kind of busts in the house and shoots her down. And it's very subtle, but he seems to kind of realize that she wasn't the right Sarah because, like, nothing's changed. He's still there and the timeline hasn't altered. So he kind of walks back to the police car and starts continuing looking for the right Sarah Connor. So I do think that there's a kind of, he wouldn't have been like, well, I killed her, everything's fine. It would have been like, well, oh crap, I'm still here. Guess I still didn't kill the right person. So fair enough. What did you think though, Will? I did want to bring this up, being kind of the Doctor Who nerds that we are. What did you think of the kind of time travel plot and the idea that it's a giant bootstrap paradox and a self-fulfilling prophecy that, because a lot of people have trouble wrapping their head around the fact that John has to send Kyle back so that Kyle can have sex with his mom and then John can be born kind of thing. So, yeah.
Well, when you put it like that, I thought it was a really simple kind of, with Doctor Who, it's very easy to get convoluted and, you know, continuity mistakes and whatever. Whereas with this, it seems very run-of-the-mill Doctor Who plot of, like, bootstrap paradoxes and whatever. So it really didn't matter to me. And I just thought it was, pretty basic. And it was effective in doing so.
Yeah, it works for me. And I know a lot of people that are not, like, as heavily versed in sci-fi, including my mum, who really, like it and have no problem understanding it. But likewise, I've had really frustrating conversations with people who have said, like, well, if John had to send Kyle Reese back to impregnate his mum, then who was there to send him back? And I'm like, that's the nature of the kind of, you know, the predestination paradox.
He's about to do is going to cause that in the future. So there's no mitigating factor of what he's about to do, he's able to do it up until that point.
Exactly, yeah. It's weird, but it helps me to visualize it and stuff. There's a brief line in, of all places, Star Trek Voyager, where I think it's Janeway says, one of the most difficult concepts to grasp with time travel is that sometimes effect can precede cause. And I was like, see, that's all you really need to know. He was born so that he could send it back so that he could be born. The effect came before the cause, but it's all one big loop, so it all still happens. And, you know,
precisely.
What about you, DK? Did you have any trouble understanding that? Are you kind of on board with us nerds?
No, I saw this at a very young age. I really probably shouldn't have been watching it back then, but yeah, I kind of picked up on it straight away.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Yeah, I do. I love the lore of these movies, particularly, well, the first two, that's not really, kind of falls apart after that, unfortunately. But yeah, I do love the lore and the idea that it is a head trip and yet so cool that, like, Kyle Reese is John's father. It's not like, you know, why send him back to protect her? You've got to, because he's the one that's going to be your dad. And, you know, your father is you know, younger than you and whatever else. But yeah, ultimately, I guess you could say that Sarah Connor got sperminated.
Oh, God.
And somebody did make a note that this is the only film in the franchise, spoiler alert, where mere humans oppose Terminators. Every other one has, you know, some kind of Terminator involvement. Yeah. I don't know about you guys, but I liked that the action sequences were split up with, like, Sarah and Reese going to the cops and things like that. So it did seem to give you, although things were relentless, there was a bit of a slowdown to breathe, and I appreciated that. But
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there were only like three major kind of action sequences, and they were all like dispersed. There was one at the very end. There was one in the police station about a third of the way through. And then you have the phenomenal car chase sequence, probably about two thirds of the way through.
Oh, that's so interesting, because I would say my favorite action sequence was the actual end, from when it starts to melt into his endoskeleton. But it's interesting that you preferred the car chase. That's fair enough.
Ironically, I think it plays out similar to Megan, you know, the horror film that came out this year or last
year. Oh, yeah, Megan is a ripoff of the Terminator.
It is a ripoff of the Terminator, yeah. It reminded me of that.
Yeah, very, very. Yeah, as soon as I was watching Megan and that was happening towards the end and she's gradually going, you know, bit by bit, getting reduced down, I was like, yeah, I saw the Terminator as well. And then it rips off aliens for added measure as well.
Yes, yeah.
But, yeah, anyway. So yeah, the only other thing I wanted to bring up then with regards to the writing, and it's over to you, I think, DK, you might have something about this, I'm not sure, but yeah, that iconic line, Schwarzenegger's line, he was gonna say I will come back, I believe was scripted, and then he didn't want to say I'll be back, and
he said that he didn't want to use the contraction, plus he said it sounded too feminine. I'm not sure where that came into play, but yeah, he said he wanted to say I will be back, and Cameron was having none of it.
The irony being that I'll be back is now Schwarzenegger's personal catchphrase that's used in multiple of his movies, not just the Terminator ones. But while we're on the subject of catchphrases, there are certain things that have come to be used with varying degrees of success in the Terminator movies. The other one, of course, being "Come with me if you want to live." Which, you know, it's kind of like, who's going to say, I have a bad feeling about this in Star Wars. You watch a Terminator movie, you're wondering who's going to say, come with me if you want to live. But I like it. It's kind of cool, I think.
And in the gun show, when he says, oh, you can't do that, and he says, wrong, and then just shoots him up. That was hilarious. See, that's my favorite.
Wrong.
But, yeah, wrong.
That's right. Well, we'll get to the end about, like, favorite character moment and line, because we tend to. That's fair enough. I can't really think of much else to say. So do you guys have anything else about the writing or not?
It's kind of halfway between writing and directing.
Go for it.
It's very much got the look of many movies around that time, especially around the flashback / flash forwards. But the difference, I think, how this has remained, you know, a milestone, is you get the impression that Cameron really cared about this story. A lot of those at the time were less innovative and they were more concerned with cashing in on the current trend. And as much as I'm not a big fan of Cameron in general, I've got to give him respect for that he wasn't just trying to do the next Star Wars, and he wasn't just, you know, back then he wasn't trying to do fantasy films. It was, it is very much it's not the juggernaut that it turned into. It's still a very kind of low budget.
Well, I wouldn't say it's low budget, especially not for the time. But you can see it's
yeah. But when you compare it to what it blossomed into, it's very much of its time. But I think the difference how this stuck around is just that he actually gave a damn about it.
Yeah. See, I think that's the thing. It wasn't just a low budget kind of cash in, just make something. And because, you know, for better or worse, Cameron doesn't seem to look down on sci-fi as a genre, and things like time travel and the horror sort of trappings, which a lot of people would. They'd be like, oh, I'm stuck making a B-movie, you know.
I mean, he did study under Corman, didn't he? So
he did.
He kind of brought those sensibilities with him.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it shows. So, you're both happy to move on to talking about some the direction then, talking of Cameron? So, Will, we'll come to you first again as the kind of first-time viewer. And I don't think you've seen that many James Cameron films, but what did you think of the direction of this one?
I think one of you mentioned it about the fever dream that he supposedly had, or he claims he had, and whatever. And one of the distinct things was that the Terminator like comes out of the flames and whatever.
Yes.
And I think that was probably the best realized moment in the entire film. And I think it's not a surprise if that was like the whole reason why the film was made, for that one moment, for that fever dream, because that moment kicks ass. And it's just sublime. It's beautiful. And it's the one of the instances where the animation actually looks really bloody good.
Yeah. I will say, yeah, Cameron has got, you can kind of look, I think, and there's versions of it that he drew this apparently when he woke up, and you can see that that does exist, that sort of drawing that he made of the skull coming through fire, which again kind of refutes Ellison's "you ripped me off" argument, but we're not going to get into that again. But so yeah, I think that was the key image that he definitely, that was the genesis of the idea, and he liked it so much that he uses it for the entire opening credits of Terminator 2. So, you know.
And on the topic of directing and whatever, and I think I mentioned this earlier about the police, I've mentioned this a couple times actually, the police station sequence, I love it so much, and I think the shot selection was sublime. So you have the you have low shots, you have aerial shots as well of when the Terminator comes in. You don't see much of him, but when you do see him, you have a lot of over the shoulder shots, you have a lot of high shots, whereas conversely, when you're with like the police officers and whatever, they're all sitting down, so when you get the perspective shots, you're always looking up at the Terminator. And I thought that was like a really, really good decision. Yes. Because between every cut there was like a stark contrast between the where the shot was positioned, and it works really well without being jarring, which was a surprise.
Yeah, absolutely, fully agree with you. What about you, DK? Any general direction thoughts, sir?
Yeah, following on from Will, I did love that police shootout scene, because you almost feel like you're there with Sarah, that just all this shit's happening and you're just wanting out of it. I think that was tremendously directed. But I also like the fact that a lot of, I mean, obviously it wasn't planned, but a lot of guerrilla shooting took place on this, which I think adds to the general sense of tension throughout the film. In that they couldn't get licenses for a lot of the film, or they didn't even try and get licenses for a lot of the film because they didn't have any money. And so just basically turned up in the middle of the night with a camera, shot what they could, and then, you know, got the hell out of Dodge.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Cool. Yeah, well, I just had a few notes that I wanted to bring up. First of all, as I was kind of alluding to kind of reinforce my point that it's almost a horror film, I think it's worth noting that there are the fake jump scares, which we are now tired of in these films. But more importantly, you see things from the killer's point of view with the now famous like Terminator vision, which I think is quite telling as well. It's obvious that that's kind of why that's there. The things like, you know, the police denying and saying it's probably a guy on PCP or whatever, is another sort of trope of that genre. But I just think it has the look and the tone and the general feel of a horror movie, the way that it ramps up to the final act showdown, like I mentioned. But yeah, and as we've already touched on, tech noir being a sort of, I guess, dark, grainy look is maybe a staple of this new genre. And I think it is quite gritty in a way that the other one's much more of a slick action movie that Cameron directed, T2. But yeah. But yeah, in terms of Cameron, then the future war scene is, first of all, fantastic opening, but it also seems to have a lot of the James Cameron trademarks for me, like advanced technology and like blue lighting and blue crackling lightning is another thing that turns up in this and Aliens and T2. And it seems very Cameron-esque. It's perhaps these things that mark him out as an auteur. But yeah, so I was wondering if you guys had similar thoughts. Does this look like a Cameron film? Did you spot things that made you think, oh, I recognize that from somewhere else, or what?
It does have similar lighting, and obviously the actors. It's got a vibe about it. It settles in, especially his, you know, his work in the '80s with The Abyss and T2 and stuff like that. Not so much things like Titanic.
No, but yeah.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
I mean, that's not really... But then again, I mean, even Titanic in the last act becomes a very survival against the odds Cameron action horror kind of movie to us.
Especially with the Titanic splitting scene. It reminds me of that scene when they teleport in... teleport through the future and whatever. Time travel.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, I mean, like I said, I love so much about those scenes in the future, including the transition of the treads running over like human skulls to the kind of the current day, whatever it is, JCB thing with treads, or the Sarah going to sleep and then us flashing then to see the base and the survivors and the dogs that were able to sniff out the Terminator that was the basic, more basic model that was played by a friend of Schwarzenegger's. I really like all of those scenes, and again, I wouldn't remove any of them from the film, but yeah. So the next sort of point I wanted to bring up to you guys is, do you think the film is violent? Because I was surprised watching it back, because I have a memory of it being quite horror and violent, and yet it seems like it's quite tame. A lot of the stuff's not shown, or it's played off screen. Yeah, so what did you think about that? Do you think it's a violent movie at times? Is there anything that's too far? Will, start with you.
Well, I think the death count is very high, so I would definitely say that it's a violent film, especially with all the authority, like the police officers being killed and whatever. So
it doesn't show you them getting gunned down, though, in fairness, does it really?
Does it not?
No.
Kind of.
Not brutally. I mean, I've seen much more brutal kind of mass murder killing type scenes.
But I did, well, similarly, I did like how you guys reviewed John Wick recently. I do like how the people in the clubs actually did react to the violence, and not like in John Wick where they just like watch Matt homicide and just dance to it. So I think for that club sequence where she calls the police for the first time, that was very violent, even though the attention was only on one person. I think a lot of people were caught in the crossfire. So.
Yeah,
I kind of get your point. There's not so much blood, and like when you did see someone get gunned down, it was usually from behind them, I noticed. So yeah.
It implies a lot of violence, which it doesn't quite show, but I think it still sticks with you weirdly, so it's effective.
I
love that club sequence, by the way. I love that Cameron switches to slow-mo to show basically Sarah going through that motion of, oh, shit,
There's so many moments that when you mention it, I just think, oh, that's just peak. It's a fantastic film.
It is very well made and directed, but, so what about you in terms of the violence, DK? How did you respond to it?
Like Will was saying, there would have been a time when I thought this was particularly violent, but having watched John Wick, it's kind of nothing now, really. And that's probably a harsh indictment in its own.
Maybe we've become desensitized.
I mean, fun fact about the police station, they mentioned that there's 30 cops. It does actually show 30 cops getting hit by bullets.
It does, but then in Terminator 2, it says that
the Terminator 17. Killed
17 people.
Yeah.
So a lot of them survived, apparently.
He's just a bit shit.
Yeah.
As Terminators go, you know, those are rookie numbers. You got to pump those numbers up.
No, I thought it was weird because at the opening, well, not the opening, but the start of the movie, there is that guy getting his heart ripped out, and yet you don't see it. It happens off screen. And I was like, that's so weird because I remember that way more viscerally than it actually happens. And even the killing of the first Sarah Connor is completely off screen. It switches to slow-mo and you don't really see anything. There are a couple of things that I think push the envelope a bit, though. The first one of those is in one of the future flashes. It shows one of the resistance soldiers literally getting blown apart, which shocked me because I didn't remember that at all. And I was like, wow, okay, woof. That was a bit much. And obviously the Terminator, the T-800 gouging out its own eye, is potentially gory, except for the fact that whatever bloody dummy that they put in is just thoroughly unconvincing to modern eyes, which I always get. That's one thing I was disappointed at in terms of introducing you to this movie, Will. I was like, he's not going to love that scene because it has aged dreadfully. It's clearly a dummy. Did you think that way, or were you kind of like, oh, I can suspend disbelief?
I cannot suspend disbelief.
That's fair enough. Fair enough. Yeah. But yeah, just to bring up some other things, I like that, as I said, there's a lot of slow pans revealing things. There's a few too many shots, though, of just framing a face. So you can tell that it's early in Cameron's career. He hasn't learned how to be dynamic and to not just do extreme close-ups whenever characters have dialogue. I do know that the movie gets bright as soon as we see Sarah and her world gradually gets darker. As I've mentioned, I love things like the slow zooming and the dramatic tension. I was curious where the T-800 got the sweet new leather jacket and shirt for the end of the movie, but again, we'll break out the Joel gif for that one just for you, DK. But yeah, and I just loved little touches like the glowing red eyes on the Terminators in the future Flash and on Arnie, even as they are in full form. I just think it's exquisite, and showing Sarah's picture burning, you know, to cut to her then in the present day is another great like transition. And there's a lot of those kind of things. So yeah, kudos to Cameron. It turns out director that knows what he's doing. So any last
believe it or thoughts? Not after reading your Way of Water review, holy crap.
Well, I just didn't like that one film.
I've looked on a film.
Well, I haven't watched it yet. I've got it on video or on DVD in the other room, but I can't bring myself to watch it. But having said that, Cameron insists that he didn't really direct most of that. It was one of those things where the producer barged in, took over and did most of the work. And then, you know, so Cameron didn't have a lot of say. He was just sat there like, well, I guess I'm yet to pick up a paycheck. So, but no, I'm a huge James Cameron fan. I always have been. And The Way of Water is the first one of his movies that I've utterly thought was bad. I mean, I adore Terminator 2, Aliens, True Lies. I love Titanic even. The first Avatar's fine, as you'll know if you've watched our review. It's, you know, it's not bad. But yeah, I mean, come on. Anybody who, three movies in a row, more or less, apart from The Abyss is in there. But yeah, Terminator, Aliens and Terminator 2, just absolute genre legend. But anyway, any last notes on Cameron or in direction in general before we move to VFX?
Did like the you know, obviously inspired by things like Carpenter's Halloween, you know, each time that you think the Terminator is done away with and it comes back.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I really did like, and that's why I love that final scene, is the way that it is so relentless. It starts off with the really cool effect of Schwarzenegger, which I really love the effect. It's thoroughly convincing, which shocked me for the time, where he's got the little, what looks like the metal giving way underneath the skin at first. And then obviously, you know, they resort to stop motion as soon as he's burned to just the endoskeleton. But then, like I said, she splits that in half and it still keeps coming. And then she thinks she's, you know, destroyed it and it still keeps coming. And in the end, she has to full on, you know, press it with one of those machine presses to crush it into nothing. So,
I know it's only a minor thing as well, but I love the opening credits. They're so understated with the Fidel's music. And it's almost nondescript. It doesn't really prepare you for what's coming. Again, it has that early 80s, low budget, this isn't going to be that, you know, straight to video kind of vibe. And I just love it. I just love it.
I love it when, I love any movie that begins with a little sort of, you know, overly dramatic bit of exposition, like in the year of darkness. And I love the fact that the Terminator poster actually has a little bit of that on it as well. Look at that exposition. Yeah. The tagline is like, in the year of darkness, the machine sent back one thing through time that would, and it was called the Terminator. I'm like, that's a long ass tagline. That's basically a plot synopsis. You know? But anyway, so.
But I do agree with you, Michael. Back to the final scene where she's crushing him. I do like how it felt very claustrophobic with the hands coming through the bars, and then Sarah was pushed back against the wall and whatever.
Oh, it almost gets her.
So condensed into one tiny little room. And I thought, even though he's behind the bar, he's still strong enough and durable to be able to strangle her until the very final moment. Like, it's being crushed, but the light stays red for like the longest time until it literally is flat.
Absolutely. And it like dies with its hand like stretched out to try and get her, which is quite telling, you know.
Trying to last moment.
Just no thought for self-preservation or anything. Obviously, it's just literally, this is my target, I'm this close, you know. So it's brutal. I like that, yeah.
Relentless,
But yeah, speaking of the VFX, then obviously it goes without saying this is Stan Winston who did the practical effects, who is an absolute legend. If you don't know his work, look it up, but suffice to say, everything. So, DK, I have a feeling you're a bit of a fan because I know he works with the likes of John Carpenter a bit and stuff, yeah?
Yeah, I love Stan Winston. And yeah, it doesn't look great now a lot of the time, but I kind of look at it as, you know, the same way I look at Harryhausen movies. Practical effects, they'll always win me over, and I can appreciate just how much work went into this, even if it doesn't look that great to modern eyes.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I will say, I don't think a lot of it has dated that poorly. I think that one shot of the dummy in the self-repair scene has aged badly, but the rest of that scene is brilliant, and even the kind of half-face makeup, similar to my little profile avatar here, in the truck at the very end of the movie is, like, I can't see the join, it's flawless. And much respect to the, I think it's maybe Cameron or whoever was writing that came up with the idea of stop motion is very jerky, so let's just give the Terminator a limp before it becomes the endoskeleton so that we can disguise that jerkiness by it's dragging its foot because one of its like ankle pistons or whatever is broken. And I was like, that's okay, because that gives you a little ability to accept that, I think, a bit easier, suspend that disbelief. So, but yeah, the stop motion, as you say, hasn't exactly aged fantastically, but I just love how iconic that endoskeleton design is. It's just so cool. It's still, you know, people still buy figures of it and merchandise that looks like it, and it's just a brilliant design. So kudos.
It's a fantastic design, and I think I agree with you just because of in the close-up shots, it does look fantastic when you actually get to see the details of it. Whereas with the wide shots, I did just like gravitate towards, it just doesn't look good.
Yeah, you are a younger audience though, and you probably aren't that used to technology pre-CGI, as I said. So I did have an inkling you'd probably find it a lot more like, oh, this is very ropey. But, you know, I don't think you would say it took huge amounts away from the movie still. So.
No.
I'll put it this way. I preferred this to Scorpion King.
Oh, good Lord. I'd prefer eating my own shit to the Scorpion King. Oh, anyway.
I'll take that one off.
So, yeah, any other thoughts on the VFX? And then I'll switch to music after that.
Well, I just thought the cyborg eye, when Arnie was, like, still fleshed out, so to speak, like, when he's looking in the mirror, and it's just, like, it's just so seamless, and I just thought that was exquisite, and how they could like pull that off back in the day, you'd think there'd be a few lumps, or like it was clearly like added on, but no, it literally looks like he was a cyborg. So that was really impressive.
I can't wait for you to see Terminator 2, because the effects more of that. Just not so much that, but every one of the effects in it are groundbreaking, and it is the kind of the basis of every kind of effect, including CGI and stuff that we have now, and
that still holds up.
Yeah, maybe I'm biased, right, but to me, because it is like T2 is my favorite film of all time, but to me, I think every bit of that special effects and stuff holds up even to modern audiences, considering it's 1991, and I think it all just looks amazing. So I'm intrigued to see if you would agree or not, but we'll see.
I'll be watching it this weekend.
Awesome. Cool. So yeah, we'll move on to the music and sound, because we've already kind of mentioned, but obviously the score by Brad Fidel. How good is it, that iconic main theme with the whole, like, do-do-do-do-do-do, the way it emphasizes, you know, machines and electronic in nature and being metallic and futuristic. And it's also relentless, just like the T-800, and brings to mind, like, the Jaws theme like that. And so that was my key thing, is just Fidel's kind of score, you know?
Yeah, you said so yourself, it's iconic.
It is, it's iconic for a reason. Will, what were you saying?
Sorry. It feeds into the surrounding, like, things that occurs. Like you mentioned, the machines is usually very in sync with what we see on screen. And I really appreciate that.
Yeah, because it is, like I said, the relentless pounding beat that I think it adds to your sense of tension of like, oh, good Lord, it's still coming. Something's out there. And, you know, it helps. That's music, you know, enhancing the experience, I think. So, absolutely. But I didn't really have any other thoughts beyond that, except, yeah, great, fantastic, iconic score. There's nothing else for now, then. I did want to go over some of the deleted scenes, if you guys don't mind.
I've not seen them. I'll just let you roll with it, yeah.
I mean, they're on the Blu-ray, so you could watch them anytime, because that's all I've got. But, yeah, I mentioned already the Terminator kind of seemingly realizing he's killed the wrong Sarah. There is an entire arc for Traxler, that is the Paul Winfield character, as he softens to Sarah and Kyle, starts to believe Kyle Reese, And there's even a scene of him handing over his gun to Kyle Reese while he dies and insists that Kyle keeps Sarah alive no matter what, which explains where Kyle gets the gun in the final act, which, again, I don't think bothered anybody. Nobody was wondering, but it's interesting that that scene exists and is there. There is a really long and important scene that lasts 4.5 minutes that I truly wish they'd kept in, because it starts with Sarah telling her mother to stay at the cabin instead of coming for her, which explains another apparent plot hole. Then it has Sarah find the Cyberdyne systems themselves in the phone book and insist to Kyle that they go there to blow it up and prevent the whole future war. Now, obviously, DK, you and I know that these are ideas that would eventually happen in Terminator 2, but it does explain a little bit of the fact that they end up at what is a Cyberdyne factory in the final act, since it's likely that's where they were heading, with a convenient steel press. But there are also brilliant scenes of acting, like Sarah coming into her strength as she insists on this mission and Reese saying it's too tactically dangerous. And then she kind of exclaims she's a human being, not a mission, and she can't keep living in terror, waiting on the Armageddon coming. And he breaks down with emotion that, you know, I should never have seen the beauty of this world. The world I'm from isn't like this. And that's when you also get that repeated line, there's no fate but what we make for ourselves. And he kind of agrees to go along with it. So I did like that. And the final one was just at the factory after the showdown between Sarah and the, you know, destruction of the T-800. An employee finds the chip from the T-800's arm that's been left there and tells the chap that he's with to rush it to R&D. And we pan out to reveal that that place is Cyberdyne Systems, which again would have been an interesting setup for the sequel, which they kind of do later anyway. So, yeah. I'm going to start with favourite character then, and we'll begin with you, Will, and ask who was your favourite character of the movie.
I'm just an evil, ruthless bastard. I'm going to pick the Terminator.
My word, that is a shocker for me, considering he doesn't have much of a character. But
it's just the okay. It's just the one-liners. You know me.
I do. You are a heartless machine. But anyway, okay. The Terminator. Slightly worried about that. Won't be reporting you to the psychiatrists at all. But anyway, DK, who was your favourite character in the movie?
As much as it would have been Reese, had you asked me earlier in life, I'm going to go with Sarah. She gets such an insane amount of character development in such a small time. Goes from being completely overwhelmed to being a survivor by the movie's end. She's got one hell of a character arc. Most would have collapsed completely under the pressure, including me.
Yeah, and I already have this written down as notes, but I'm just echoing exactly what you said, which is that Sarah is my favorite character in the film. Her evolution in Terminator 2 is what's talked about, but I think it's already here that we see her grow from this waitress to badass and victim to final girl. And as you said, it's an actual character arc that we can track throughout the movie, which is a rarity in this day and age. Awesome. So what was your favorite moment or scene, Will, you were going to tell us?
You can't do that. Wrong.
The gun shop with the poor Dick of Miller course. At the beginning there. Fair enough. You really do have a sadistic streak, don't you? But, anyway. DK, what about you?
When the Endoskeleton steps out of the flames, I cannot tell you how much that ignited in my imagination as a child. Leaves an impact. And it will be four scenes like that were everywhere. I give Cameron a lot of flack, but yeah, it's iconic.
It is. What were you saying, Will?
And that's not sadistic, Michael?
Well, I mean, it's admiring the direction.
As was I. The comedic
But no, that's fair enough. No, I get you. That's understandable. No, I like so many of the scenes, but I did have to, you know, narrow it down because I insist on doing it. And so I think my favorite is, as I kind of already said, the Tech Noir Club scene. The tension of like stalking through the hazy dark, the reveals of, you know, Sarah and the Terminator, the iconic lines, that's where you get the come with me if you want to live. I just think it's perfection. That scene is a masterclass in how to do things. So that would be the one I would pick. So finally, what would you say is your favorite line of the movie? And Will, we'll start with you.
Is there a cop-out to say, I'll be back?
Not at all. Not at all.
I will choose that. I will be back. Just because you also do it for the outro of your podcast itself. You know, I'm repping your podcast here.
Exactly, you are. It's a lovely bit of symmetry. Cool. What about you, DK?
It's listen and understand. That Terminator is out there. It can't be bargained with. It can't be reasoned with. It doesn't feel pity or remorse or fear. And it absolutely will not stop ever until you are dead.
That was literally mine, and I actually have it here.
Listen and understand that Terminator is out there. It can't be bargained with. It can't be reasoned with. It doesn't feel pity or remorse or fear, and it absolutely will not stop ever until you are dead.
Yeah, I love that as well, because it just gives you everything.
You sample sparingly for the final hours, so I do respect
that. That was it. I just knew that I had that saved, and I was like, I'll drop that, because I could read it out, but I wouldn't have the delivery that Michael Biehn does on that line, and it is fantastic, DK. You're absolutely right. Did not expect you to pick the same thing as me, but that was a pure accident. But anyway, so we will eventually head to our conclusions and scores, but before we do that, we often throw things open to our audience to ask what you think of these things. And again, this falls into DK's purview. So DK, you've gathered the audience's response to the Terminator, do you?
Have them there for us? Yep. I'll start with good old Adrienne on our Discord server. She says, this is one of my favorite movies to rediscover. I love future Sarah Connor so much, and here is where we meet her as the innocent waitress. Also, damn, but Michael Biehn is hot. The last 30 minutes are action-packed, and I love every moment of the Jeep scenes. Sandy, also on our Discord, says, the Terminator, it's an awesome action movie that I think even still holds up today, from iconic lines to iconic scenes. Arnold Schwarzenegger owns them all. I can't imagine anyone other than Linda Hamilton playing Sarah Connor, especially when we see the powerhouse she becomes in the next film. Spoilers. The action is intense, from the car chases to the assault on the police station, and finally the factory at the end. The time travel and futuristic layer solidifies the film as another masterpiece in James Cameron's, and then she's put in brackets, sorry DK, belt. Now, I do have to agree with her on that. Lgage 1979 on the Discord says, I would agree, sci-fi, horror, action all rolled into one. Definitely creates a huge paradox, though, kind of chicken and egg scenario. Interestingly enough, Schwarzenegger only had somewhere about 65 lines for the entire film. He wishes.
I think that was a typo, to be fair. Oh.
Johnny W. Staggs says, the first Terminator movie is still my favorite of the franchise. It's a tight story filled with atmosphere and suspense. It's my second favorite Cameron movie after Aliens. I saw it after I saw T2, though. I got the DVD from a friend, watched it, and loved it. Jamie says, whilst not as good as T2, the first Terminator film is still fantastic. It's got fantastic action throughout, brilliant suspense, a really great pace, effects way ahead of its time, engaging characters, and it's just a brilliant film. It definitely does get overshadowed by the sequel, but the original is still absolutely fantastic. Sourish Guide, is that Theo?
It is Theo, yeah, on our Discord.
Yeah, he says, it's all right.
He did the Sam Milliken Award for this week. Clearly, my brother didn't chime in this week for once.
Yeah, and Christian says, I'll concur. It's all right. I think it lays a really good foundation for the masterpiece that is T2. Lee Gage says, love the film. It has one of my favorite delivered lines. And then he gives our favorite line.
Yeah.
He says, but if you are doing Terminator, I beg of you, dive into the paradox of time travel. John sends Reese back to protect Sarah before John is born, but because Reese is John's father, how did John exist in the future to send Reese back?
We did talk about that, and we didn't have an issue. Oh, I didn't say that.
I did.
You can take that flag.
Yeah. Taking the heat off us for once.
You're welcome. Glad to be back, guys.
Hey, we've got another whipping boy. It's awesome.
Great.
Paul says, I watched 1 and 2 for the first time recently for a film club. Terminator is a good action film, but I don't think it would be particularly special if it wasn't the first of this. What? If it wasn't the first of the series. Story is okay. Performances are good, but not amazing. It does launch Cameron's and Schwarzenegger's careers, though, and is noticeable for that. I think we've got a hot take award.
I was just going to say that's getting a hot take award there.
I much preferred Terminator 2. It feels more sci-fi and has better performances, effects, etc. And we've got a couple here from Letterboxd. The first one is from Demi. It says, I don't think I've ever seen a film with better storytelling. Next to zero expository dialogue in the first act, everything is set up through action and done so perfectly. One of Cameron's best. Alec on Letterboxd says, with impressive action sequences, fantastic direction, and relentlessly fast pacing, it's clear why this movie is still an influence on sci-fi flicks to this very day. And Paul on Letterboxd says, the economy of storytelling in this is just unreal. Quite honestly, zero wasted moments. Every single piece is building on one idea or moment or bridging to the next. The last budget-strapped movie he ever made, and as much as I love what he does on a grand scale, I'd be so fascinated to see Cameron make something this stripped down again. Mm-hmm. The ability to imply scope and scale is what makes high aspiration slash low budget sci-fi work. And all the stops are being put out here to make it all feel comprehensive. And I'm going to give special shout out to Paul on that one because he agrees that it was low budget too.
It was low budget.
Fair enough. Okay. And was that everything, yeah?
That's all we have this time.
Awesome. Well, I did have a quick question for when we conclude our conclusions and score, but we will start with that. And as we tend to do, we'll start with our guest, Will. You are back new to the podcast, but you know the drill. Do you have a conclusion and a score out of 5 stars for us, please?
I do. And on my Top Gun, it's not just solid. I do apologize for that. So my conclusion is as follows. An overall fantastic film that falls just shy of a perfect score because of its brief dialogue shortcomings and mostly bad animations. I'm sorry, Mike. The casting is wholly inspired and the crew knocked out of the park, depicting a bleak world merging with our quote-unquote reality, in turn bringing the bleakness along with it. And as such, I give Terminator a 4.5 out of 5.
Fantastic. Can't say fairer than that, really. But yeah, I'm really pleased you liked it, as I said, considering I introduced you to it this for the first time. So
I have a feeling Terminator 2 is just going to be out 5 out of 5.
I really hope so, because like I said, it is my favorite movie of all time. I've always said that. When I worked at a cinema, briefly we were told to tell them our favorite movie to put on our badge, and my badge said Michael Terminator 2.
So, yeah. But then again, we did disagree with Alien and Aliens. I prefer Alien because it's such a phenomenally and like effective horror, whereas Aliens goes too actiony for me. So maybe we'll disagree again. Who knows?
Maybe don't go in expecting just the greatest thing, because that the only way to go is disappointment after that. But that's cool. Fair enough. Awesome. DK, then your conclusion and your score out of 5, please.
Yeah, I've just got to say it, Will. I prefer Alien to Aliens 2, and I still think T2's better. So, yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
Hopefully you enjoy that one. It's difficult to imagine now, where the Terminator is, dodgy franchise entries notwithstanding, a juggernaut. But prior to the sequel, when this was first released, it was a relatively small picture, so much so that the company behind it spent virtually no money on marketing. There was no big hoopla in the school playground on this one, as there had been with Empire Strikes Back or RoboCop. It was just something a few lucky people had seen. It was low budget, it was grimy, but it blew our minds. It's been just shy of 40 years since that time, and we've had so many sequels, imitations, homages, and plain old knockoffs since then that it's hard to put into words just how jaw-droppingly awesome this thing was at the time. And while we may have had something similar in other creative fields, as movies go, this was a game-changer. Story's a compelling one, 3 leads give great performances, drawing you into the world, and the direction for someone on their official first feature is outstanding. I may not get along with Cameron's fixations nowadays, but there's no denying that back during this era, he was legendary. Fidel's soundtrack is as memorable as anything that Morricone produced, and while yes, the effects haven't aged well at all, I can appreciate the artistry that went into them. It's considered a classic for a reason, and while I may not return to it as much as I do other movies from that era, it will always hold a special place in my heart, and I've also given it 4.5.
Fair enough. Awesome. I will say, I should probably have mentioned this sooner, and I can't believe I haven't brought it up yet, but I will say, as much as after Terminator 2, the franchise falls off a cliff and you kind of don't have to bother with it, I will say, with regards to that fact, though, do seek out, if you can, Terminator the Sarah Connor Chronicles, the short-lived 2-season series, which is fantastic and is reminiscent of the quality of these first 2 Terminator movies. Criminal that it got cancelled and it ended on a cliffhanger, but it's well worth a watch if you get a chance to seek it out, and not just because Summer Glau's in it, you know. And not to mention Lena Headey as well. But
directed at me, that was, I think.
Well, you know, I know our audience. But yeah, with that said, I'll move on to my conclusion and score then. I've said it's a futuristic science fiction time travel slasher-esque horror movie. Is it a surprise that I love this? The central plot and ideas captured my imagination from the start, and there's a reason that they launched a massive franchise that ironically will not die despite a number of terrible sequels. It's early in Cameron's career, arguably his first movie, as you said, but already you can see some auteur-worthy trademark touches, and that, bar a couple of more basic moments, he is a talented force to be reckoned with. So much works here. The casting is totally on point. The performances all thoroughly convincing. The exposition is delivered naturally, not dumped on you all at once, and the atmosphere is palpable. The whole thing is just thoroughly entertaining and engrossing. If I'm nitpicking, then there are the more basic directing touches that I mentioned, like too many close-ups or use of cliche slow-mo. Likewise, while most of the special effects are unbelievably good, especially for the time, there are some moments that have dated badly and where the technology just wasn't quite there yet. The sequel would be where all the ambitious ideas would get to be played out, and the franchise really hits its highest note for me. But don't write this film off as a mere setup. It is vital to get you to the next part of the story, but on its own, it's still a near-perfectly executed, genre-innovating, tense, zippy, and incredibly influential movie. One of my favorites, and one of those films I can pop in anytime and still enjoy. I guess my love for it absolutely will not stop. Ever. And weirdly enough, I also gave it 4.5 or 4.5 out of 5. Which, the average of... It's 4.5 out of 5 for the... So, yeah, that's pretty bloody good. I mean, the odds of us all giving the exact same score, let alone that being the final. But I'm happy with that because obviously I agree.
You, Mike. We never agree on scores, but here we
are. I know, right? Absolutely. But, I did have a question that I wanted to get to. But first of all, I did promise DK that I would share this meme he found earlier today. And again, if you're listening and not watching on our YouTube channel, go and subscribe to our YouTube channel or you'll miss out. So, there you go. Just for you, Will, if you can see it. Probably not because you're on your phone, I think. But yeah.
I can see it.
It's an older Linda Hamilton and Schwarzenegger, obviously playing Sarah Connor in the Terminator, yes. And Sarah's saying, "So you're not a Terminator anymore?" To which Arnie replies, "Negative, I retired. Now I kill bugs. I am an ex-Terminator." So that was for you, DK. You insisted.
Thank you.
You're to blame for that one. So, So before we go then quickly, I did want to say, because I'm just curious, Will, how many James Cameron movies have you actually seen?
Ooh, right. To Letterboxd I go.
He hasn't made that many, so it's, like I say, Piranha 2, arguably, The Terminator, Aliens, The Abyss, T2.
The third film I've seen, Titanic, this one, and Aliens, I believe. I've cool. seen neither of the Avatar ones, none of his more niche ones. Niche,
you've never
I
seen
say.
True Lies or The Abyss or anything like
I
that?
I think I may have seen True Lies, but a long, long time ago when I was a kid.
You'd remember if you'd seen that Jamie Lee really? Curtis stripper sequence.
Oh, that's where that gift comes from.
Yeah. But, anyway, so where would you say this ranks among the three that you've seen?
Oh, that's a really good question. I like you.
Thank you.
No,
I hate him.
I like you too.
Okay, I'm not going to do that bit. I'm skipping over it. You've had good views. Titanic is a phenomenal film, like you would agree. So I am unashamedly going to say Titanic is probably my favourite film that I've seen of his. Then it would go Terminator 1, and then it would be Aliens, but that's no discredit to it. I think the director's cut is arguably better than Terminator 1 if we're just going by my school's life, given three. But just fair enough. Usual cut, I would say Aliens third. Yeah, 100%.
Fair enough. DK, I'm guessing you, like me, have seen all, if not almost all, of the Cameron movies.
I've seen pretty much everything apart from things like Ghost of the Abyss, Aliens of the
Deep. I don't count the documentaries, but I probably should.
Fair enough. I even think I've seen Piranha 2 when I was very, very young.
I think I have when I was super young, but I can't remember it, so I wouldn't like to say that I had. Yeah. And I did buy the DVD because it was, I got the DVD for like £1.08 on eBay and was like, do you know what? I'll buy it just to watch it again sometime.
That's fair enough. You may have paid a pound too much there, to be honest. But...
Ouch.
I think the only one of his that I haven't seen in that case is Way of Water.
Cool. And where would you put this then amongst the Cameron films that you've seen?
Do you know something? I think I might put this, honestly, because it was so new and original, I think I might put this above Terminator 2 and slap it straight in at number one.
Wow. And you just told Will that you thought Terminator 2 was better.
It is. It's a better film, but I'm going on an emotional level, and this impacted me in a way that Terminator 2 didn't, because I'd kind of seen some of it before.
Okay, fair enough.
I've reviewed Terminator 2 along the line.
We definitely have to. Yeah. I mean, it's my favorite film of all time, so I probably would be biased going in, but I have lots I could say.
I think I can guess Mike's score on that episode.
It's pretty obvious.
That one.
It's literally the background, because I have the Letterboxd Patreon, and it picks your favorite movie as your background. So it's the T2 Arnie that is my background to Letterboxd. My Cameron ranking then, this would come third for me. Number one would be T2. Obviously, number two would be Aliens. Then this would be number three. But those are all a very close top three. I think suffice to say we all like the movie a lot, but I just was curious.
Mine's pretty much the same top three, but just in a different order.
And you could pretty much shuffle them around. I mean, for argument's sake, you could say they're almost, I mean, especially Terminator 2 and Aliens, I would say are probably both 5 stars if we're classing the director's cut of Aliens. And it's just literally I have to pick one of them to be superior, and T2 has the more emotional impact to me, because it was one of those, you know, made you fall in love with films in the same way as Jurassic Park or Superman were. But so all that remains now then is for me to say thank you, Will, for finally rejoining us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's good fun. As always, awesome.
And I believe you will be back hopefully a few times from now on. We're going to have you on regularly and doing some editing, hopefully. But if I'm not mistaken, you're coming back for our very next episode. Is that right?
So sorry if you didn't like me with this episode. I'm coming back to review Donnie Darko, I believe.
Yes, I was going to say that. Reveal it. It's going to be another cult episode. DK's presenting us with that, with another DK's cult. And we're going to be joined by Will, Jamie, and DK will be hosting that one and guiding us through Donnie Darko, a film that
James
I saw.
James wanted to do that one for months back on Big Screen Days. He was like, get me on for Donnie Darko. So I can't wait to speak to him, because he's a very passionate guy on that film.
It's another weird one, because it's the first time you've seen it. You've already said it was on your list to watch, so you'll be glad to cross it off. It's a film that I saw a couple of times but haven't seen for at least 10 years, and DK seems to know his stuff when it comes to that one. So you looking forward to that, DK?
Definitely. I'm just gonna try and find all the behind the scenes nonsense for that now.
There's lots of it.
I'm sure finishing.
Exactly. But you can always find us, as I tend to say, in the episode description. You can find our link trees and the links to find the podcast and our various places throughout the internet. You can also still submit a movie for us to review. As Virgin I said, if you go back and watch if you go back and watch our 200 subscribers video, we threw open the floodgates to you to say if you want to suggest something. We'll take the thing with the most suggestions, or we'll do a little surprise draw.
DK watch Lady in America and just be completely blown away.
So, if you don't want us to have to watch Laid in America, please suggest anything else to that one. And, Will, did you have anywhere you wanted to shout out where the people can find you?
You can find me on Instagram, and that's pretty much it nowadays. So,
And, we do have something coming up on the Who Game Shows channel again soon as well.
Of course. That will be out by the time this comes up, I believe. A game show called Jeopardy that apparently no one's heard of before.
I have.
You have, because you were a kid when it came out in the 70s.
If only I don't have the sound clip of him saying, fuck you, asshole. If only I did.
Well, we did that, and it's coming out very well. So, give that a go. And, more game shows to come, and perhaps another game show from Michael in a coming month or two.
Maybe.
Yeah. Before we move on. Lady in America on Letterboxd, then. Oh, hell no.
You don't strike me as a man who's like into YouTube culture. Michael is like a little bit. He's dipped his toes into it. He knows who KSI is and whatever. I just think you'd be like completely lost, and I think the reaction on the recording would just be a sight to behold, DK. So I want to see you do that.
Well, one of the reviews literally is, I chuckled once. I will regret that for the rest of my life.
We can't do a review anywhere near as good as that. But yeah, we shall see. So thanks everyone for joining us. And do come back for in a couple of weeks' time, I believe, when we'll be dropping our cult Donnie Darko review. And stay tuned. We have lots of things coming down the pike for you to enjoy. So it seems very fitting to give our usual send-off. But who wants to take us out with that today?
Yes, sure, I'll do it.
Yeah.
Go for it then, Will.
Fuck you, asshole.
I knew you were going to say that. In the epic words of Arnie, we'll be back. Or should I say,
I'll be back.
Bye.
Bye.
You have been listening to the Silver Screen Podcast, hosted by Michael Wilson and DK. Created, produced, and edited by Michael Wilson. Behind the scenes sections and additional material produced by DK. Music by Timeless Journey. More information can be found at soundcloud.com/timelessjourney. Follow the podcast on Instagram at Silver Screen Podcast, or look for the Silver Screen Podcast under Facebook groups. Links to all our social media accounts and more are in this episode's description. This podcast is available on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. Just look for Silver Screen, Hit or Miss Star Trek. This has been a Mike's Podcast production, copyright 2022. Thank you for listening.